Tomas, how are you?
I'm not too bad. That's good. Fine 2015. It will take me at least 6 months to start writing the checks, if there were checkbooks anymore, with 2015 on it.
Checkbooks are gone.
Yeah, they are.
They almost ban you from the bank. They don't even want to see people in the bank now.
No, you notice that?
If you go there, you'll find the counter is staffed by like one person, you see. And then there's six or seven other people around a desk doing, as far as I can see, nothing. And every now and then one of them comes over to the big, long, huge queue and says, if any of you want to use the machine over here, come in, I'll show you. Or if you want to do something here, or if you want to do a 24-hour banking over there. But please don't disturb any of us at all. We don't want to interact with you anymore. It's weird.
Well, I mean, when I arrive now at my bank, they come over and they look at a list, and I'm going, you know, will I get into this nightclub or not? That's what I'm trying to figure out, you know. But, you know, I'm only here to give, and they're, oh, fair enough, over there to that machine over there. So, oh, my goodness.
Here we are on the exact, it's the 9th of January, the exact 30th anniversary of the first rehearsal of the Philharmonic Choir. So it's an exact 30th birthday here this evening. Great to see it happening. Wonderful also to see a piece specially commissioned from a living Irish... they'd have to be living to be commissioned from, I suppose.
I think it's always important to commission from the living.
Yeah, very important. Commissioned from Elaine Agnew, very well-regarded Irish contemporary composer with a serious back catalogue of work there. Now, I first came across her work back maybe 15 years ago. The Irish Chamber Orchestra were playing a piece, Strings Astray, by her, by Elaine. And they had commissioned it from her a few years prior to that and had performed it on a number of occasions. She's very well regarded. It just makes me think a bit, Tomás, you know, it's absolutely vital that this process of commissioning from contemporary composers remains and is sustained, because otherwise classical music will lose its vitality. I mean, as I was saying to someone there earlier, you know, the Archbishop of Salzburg and his private court orchestra, in which, you know, Mozart could play around with, that's long gone. We need these institutions to do this sort of work.
Rather tragically, and if we can be pointed for a moment, wasn't there a rather very dramatic controversy during the proms, the BBC proms this year, where they had indeed commissioned some new works, but then they cut away from them, and what was broadcast was the Beethoven, the Bach, the Brahms, but what was actually on the evening, people were hearing some commissioned works, but not the general public, because they thought it might be too complicated for them.
Oh yeah, that was the prom during the summer where they had the piece, the contemporary piece by Roxana Panufnik. She's the daughter of Andrei Panufnik, very well-regarded composer. Now, that was commissioned by the World Orchestra for Peace a couple of years ago. But the whole idea there, she was trying to integrate Christian, Jewish and Muslim music into this piece. And very impressive piece, really. But again, you see, if you just hear it for the first time, Tomás, you're not perhaps engaged with it, because it's a whole different sort of dynamic and structure and things like that. You need to listen to it. I was lucky. I heard it a couple of times in rehearsal, and then saw it being performed. And I think when you see it in that setting, you can come to appreciate it. So perhaps there's an understanding, I can understand why it might have been included, but at the same time, if they're going to be making those sort of censoring decisions, then, you know, these pieces of music will never be validated by big organisations such as the BBC.
Yes, and in fact, I mean, apart from that, there were several that they commissioned themselves. The BBC commissioned them themselves and then cut them out. You know, so it's extraordinary. So
self-censoring.
I suppose we should say that, you know, here in Ireland, we have organisations that are willing to commission and then perform on the largest stage we have available, broadcast and physically here live. I mean, the only thing you would say, just the only tiny gentle thing you would say about the premiere that we've heard tonight is that the underlying basis for it, of course, is Siegfried Sassoon's Everybody Sang. Now, Everybody Sang is really, I grew up in England and I went to school in England, so that poem is taught as a celebration of the end of war, a rejection of the end of, a rejection of the idea of war, and a celebration of life. I mean, that's what it's absolutely sold as. And it's his most famous poem. So that celebratory idea is one that we've had to reject for a long time because of the connection and the troubles that we've had with our close neighbour. And what's brilliant about the piece now, and what's brilliant about the whole feeling behind what we've, you know, been experiencing here this evening, is that we can celebrate this for what it is, an end of war, and not a celebration of English imperial victory. And I think that's the real, you know, that's a real page-turner for 2015.
I think it's also nice, Tomás, that we've had, what now, six months or so of centenaries of the beginning of the war. So it was the outbreak. Now, I won't say we were celebrating, we were commemorating the outbreak of the slaughter. At least in this case here, they're celebrating the end of it. As you said, there's a certain amount of restricted joy, you might say, but saying that it is all over and we can now look forward again. So it's nice that that has been incorporated here. I love choral singing myself, I must say. I mean, I'm a bathroom baller, you know. Once I get behind the shower curtain, then I could take on Domingo or Pavarotti or anyone. But outside of that cloistered performance area, I rather stay quiet. But there is something really nice about, and I don't think of it just as choral singing, but as communal singing. It's a communal thing coming together, and it's really nice, I say, that being able to express things which perhaps you can't just do it simply in words, because words set to music essentially is poetry set to music. It reaches deeper into the soul, and I love, you know, listening to that performance there, professional sing, proper people, well able to, you know, deal with the harmony and the melody and all the rest of it. It's something which is well worth paying attention to. But can I just say to us, for me, the highlight tonight has to be, and I know we haven't even heard the Elgar yet, but I do know it. The Mozart is, I think it's a wonderful piece of work. I was talking to Hugh Tinney there earlier, and he just gave me a few insights, and he said the interesting thing is it's written in a minor key, so it's more, so he even used the word a bit tragic, but he said also it wears its heart on its sleeve. It's out there. It's you know, exultant and so forth. And he's got a great association with it because it was the first piece of a Mozart concerto. The second movement, sorry, the Romance, was the first piece of a Mozart concerto he ever learnt. His teacher Mabel Swainson, back when he was about 12 years of age, taught him this piece of work. So he's got a connection with it spanning back over the decades. And I know he certainly was really, I spoke to him before the concert, obviously, he was really looking forward to performing it. I asked him about the fact to us that, you know, during the 19th century, the work of Mozart was largely neglected, almost forgotten about, except for this piece and a few others. And he said he felt that it appealed, because of this heart-on-sleeve nature, it appealed to the Victorian age, the Romantic age, where they were perhaps slightly more bombastic or more obvious, whereas they looked back towards a lot of his other work and they tend to dismiss it a little bit as being a bit trite, a bit twee. I think the man who put his finger on the whole thing about Mozart was André Gide, and I'm just paraphrasing here now. He said that Mozart spoke in whispers, whereas most people tend only to hear shouts.
A wise man. Gide. Now, there's a name I haven't heard for a couple of days, let me tell you. I was much taken by André Gide. I had the whole idea of melancholia, particularly in my sort of 20s, right the way through to my current youthful state.
Your late
20s? My late 20s, exactly.
Very late.
Very extraordinarily late. Some people would say decades. That idea of melancholia, he really captured it. And to me, you know, Vatican Cellars, intrigue and melancholia, these are my two constant companions. And so tonight, I actually think the whole evening should actually really have been renamed Melancholia. Because even Elaine Agnew's, you know, this piece is, it's about, you know, the secret soon underlying it. There's a melancholic element to it, of course. And he was, you know, he was suffering from huge depression when he wrote the poem. And really the whole evening has that melancholic feel. The reason, in my opinion, that Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20 is what we would say, I suppose, is the thinking person's Mozart. It's the one. It's because it's very soulful and melancholic, and in that minor key, you get that melancholy, and you get it. And even if there's, you know, the constant concerto fighting between piano and orchestra goes on as we expect it to, but it isn't prancing horses. that we see in so many of the rest of his work, you know, which I think of as Lipsanzer stallions moving in and out of the symphonic sort of keyboard. But this is much more sort of this tone poem of melancholy, and it's very soft, and you know, it is an incredibly beautiful piece. But that chimed, of course, with romanticism, and that's why, you know, Beethoven carried a copy of it with him, you know, so he could slip it out and run across the boards when he required. So and even if he didn't carry it with him, it was a said of him that he, you know, this was close to his heart, and he would pull it out as his.
He wrote cadenzas for it.
He did indeed. It was a constant companion for him, and that's why it sits there at the heart of, in fact, his revival. We've got to remember that Mozart's revival really stems from the 1960s and 70s, when the delicacy of his work was able to be found again, and particularly with recording techniques. Because if you look at the early recording, you know, process in the 20th century, delicacy was not something that could be picked up upon. What you're looking for, it strikes me constantly when I'm now looking at these older recordings these days, that, you know, why Wagner and Strauss and Beethoven worked so well is because they were able to be picked up by the non-digital recording formats. And so when we finally get into good magnetic tape and good transfers away from wax, Mozart begins to shine. And, you know, when you hear it broadcast live, like tonight, you can hear the filigree thin movements, you know, that are subtle and gorgeous and romantic.
You mentioned as well, Tomas, about it being the thinking man's concerto. And Hugh would always strike me as, so he's very good at maths, you know, he's interested in astronomy. And he brings a very, I would consider, a rigorous approach to his playing. What I love about his playing as well is it's not full of all these histrionics, you know, with face scrunched up or head waving about because the artist is so affected by the music. He's getting on with making the music, with playing the music carefully. He also made a point about the piece, which chimes in with what you just said there. He said it was one of the first pieces that Mozart wrote, a first concerto that he wrote, which was symphonic in character. He said prior to that, the concerti were written almost as like lighter pieces of entertainment, as a vehicle for the soul was just to show off more than anything else. Whereas this had a much more symphonic feel to it, richer sounds and so forth. And I think it suits his approach as well. He's, you know, if you speak to colleagues of Hugh, they always say that he brings that great rigor to the way he plays music. And not just as a soloist here. You know, oftentimes you'll find people like that would be playing in a chamber quartet or a quintet. And in that case, you've got people coming together, many of whom would also play as soloists. And it's really important for them to leave their soloist's baggage at the door, because they're coming together to make the music together. Use the word, they have to work together in harmony, and I don't just mean in a musical sense. They have to work together with that, the great French word, sympa. There must be sympathy between them. And Hugh is a person who, when he's playing in that situation, say piano quintet or something, he knows when to come forward and he knows when to fade back into the background. And it's really important that chamber musicians are able to do that. And I know people would regard him highly in that respect.
Which brings us completely not to Elgar.
I find it hard to let go of Mozart. I mean, I'm looking forward now to this. When I say looking forward, I mean in the sense of just looking into the future.
Yes,
not
yes.
Anticipating with relish, dare I say. I'm sure the singing will be very good. I don't want to cast any aspersions there. But the piece itself, to most, I can't help feeling, you know, Elgar has a mixed reputation, as you know. And this piece strikes me as that it's almost as if he decided, I tell you what I'll do is I'll write a piece, I'll hand it to my critics and I'll say, now here is a very well-fashioned stick that I want to give you to beat me with.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. All doors will close in 5 minutes.
Because, you know, if, as you know, it references all these other pieces of his, Nimrod and Gerontius and so forth. So I find when I'm listening to it, that every now and then I get knocked off balance, because you say, what the heck is that? Has someone slipped in the wrong piece of music or something like that? So I'm not a huge fan of this piece, I must say. I think he did compose some great stuff. But I'm not sure. You see, Elgar... difficult to assess, really. He always remained as an, or certainly felt himself as an outsider. He was a Catholic in a Protestant land, essentially. He married up, you might say. He knew he was very much from humble background. He then did become sort of accepted by the Edwardian society he was in. And of course, if you see photographs of him, he looks very much the Edwardian gent with that great big moustache.
Now it's Elgar. Terrific moustache. Yeah. Terrific moustache.
It's Elgar's moustache I want to concentrate on.
Excellent.
It's an empire builder's moustache.
I think it is. I mean, it has heroic tornado elements. It feels like it could support the Raj on its own, you know.
But Tomás, was it his bulwark against the world? Was it his defence of it? Because this proclaimed him to be the Edwardian gent. If you think about it, think of all the other people out there in his equivalent, shall we say, in the world of letters, might be Rudyard Kipling. Mm. Also had a wouldn't have rivaled Elgar, but he might have held a candle to him. Actually, Kipling was quoted once as saying that he'd heard a lady saying that being kissed by a man who hadn't waxed his moustache was like eating an egg without salt.
Oh, my God. Well, we need to tell all of the people who are cycling retro city bikes with their moustaches and their sort of 19th century granddad shirts and horn-rimmed glasses before they go in to get 100 grams of finely ground Ethiopian coffee that they really need to get out here and start listening to Elgar if they want to have the proper soundtrack to their lives.
Funny you should mention the coffee there, Tomás, because, you know, back in those days when the lads were waxing the moustache and they were also dyeing the moustache with the hair colouring, the problem was that when they drank a cup of tea or coffee, you bring it to your lips three or four times, whatever, and the steam began to melt the wax and it turned the moustache into a total mess. So they designed these cups with like a little shelf across them, you know. They were like baby cups. You know the sort of baby cups which they didn't actually have a spout. Well, Tomás, imagine this glass here, you see, which... Will you stop that in a bit? Imagine the glass here with a little sort of shelf across it and then an aperture out of which you could drink your... Are you on the vodka or the gin tonight?
Oh, God knows. Dingle gin.
Nice stuff. Imagine that, and that's what you'd have there.
I think I have an idea, a Kickstarter idea.
Crowdfunding. Osbert Sitwell referred to Elgar as, you know, the very personification of Colonel Bogey in his grey moustache, grey hair, grey top hat and all the rest of it. But you know, there was Elgar triumphed in the end, Tomás, because back in 1999, they took Michael Faraday off the British £20 sterling note and put Elgar on. And the reason was because Faraday was clean-shaven and Elgar's moustache was harder to fake or forge.
That is startling.
I can see you're startled.
I am extremely startled.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. Thank you.